The following is the Sunday Feast Lecture given by His Holiness Srila Satsarupa Das Goswami on October 4th, 1998 in Dublin, Ireland.
I'm reading a text from the scripture Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita from the teachings of Lord Chaitanya to Rupa Goswami. Brahmanda Brahmite Kona Bhagyavan Jeev Guru Krishna Prasade Pai Bhakti Lata Bij. According to their karma, all living entities are wandering throughout the entire universe. Some of them are being elevated to the upper planetary systems. Some are going down into the lower planetary systems. Out of many millions of wandering living entities, one who is very fortunate gets an opportunity to associate with a bona fide spiritual master by the grace of Krishna, by the mercy of both Krishna and the spiritual master. Such a person receives the seed of the creeper of devotional service. So, I'll set the scene of this talk. Rupa Goswami was a minister in the government in India in the 16th century, very highly placed minister in, at that time, the Muslims were ruling India. But he was actually born as a Hindu Brahmin, but gave up his culture for government service. So Lord Chaitanya, he is understood as the incarnation of Krishna. At that time he was living as a sannyasi and traveling and teaching and demonstrating the ecstasies of pure love of God all over the country. So Rupa Goswami and his brother, at that time they weren't called Rupa Goswami, they had Muslim names. But they met Lord Chaitanya one time. They became very impressed. So they tried to come and see him and become his disciples. But Sanatana Goswami, he was put in jail. He never got to reach Lord Chaitanya at this time. But Rupa Goswami met him. And so it was a classic situation of the guru and disciple, where the disciple asks questions. I say classic, meaning the main ingredients are that the disciple has full faith in the words of the spiritual teacher and is able to hear them submissively. And the disciple is very intelligent and very earnest about inquiring into spiritual life. As I mentioned, it cost him to go there and hear from Rupa Goswami. He was willing to stake his whole life to gain these teachings. And the teacher, Lord Chaitanya, was fully aware of all the conclusions of the Vedic scriptures, not just in a bookish way, but by personal realization, so that he could convey these to a willing disciple. And the Vedas say that this simple process of hearing from a teacher is so powerful that it's really all that's needed. No other yoga is needed. What is needed to gain spiritual knowledge is, whatever your method is, you have to give up sinful life, you have to purify your mind, control your mind, just get out of the whole concept of material life being the only truth. There are many, many steps. So it can be done by practicing yoga, by meditation, and different paths. But just this one thing, hearing, can change a person's life, and he can reach perfection. But it has to be under these ideal conditions. So when Rupa Goswami inquired, Lord Chaitanya started and said, I want to speak about bhakti, love of God, but it's an ocean, so I really can't describe it. It's inconceivably vast. So what I'll do, I'll give you a synopsis, and it'll be like a drop of the ocean. And from the one drop, you can get an indication what the ocean is like. And what did he start with? He started with defining the smallest spiritual particle, which is the soul. And the soul is in every living being. In our bodies, it's the living force. It's eternal, very small, very powerful, and completely pure. So the fact that now we don't realize our soul means that we don't have self-realization. We think that we're our body. I am a man, or you think you're a woman, and so on, so forth. The ultimate reducible particle of spirit is the soul. So then Lord Chaitanya said, these souls are inhabiting many, many different species of life, and they're counted up as 8,400,000 from the different little microbes and beasts. He made a general division. Some move and some can't move, like plants can't move, but there's a soul in the plant, and it grows and it gives off byproducts. It has a life duration and so on. That's why in the Krishna consciousness movement, we try as far as possible to refrain from killing any life, plant life, animal life, because they all have souls. It's not that only a human being has a soul. So there are all these different species of life. And then he said, among them, the human group, what we call human, is very small by comparison. And there are some 400,000 species. And most of those are not civilized, hardly human. But then he was going through a process of focusing on the more eligible, the more advanced, and then even more advanced. So more advanced than the plants and the beasts are the humans. But out of all the humans, those who follow some kind of religion are better. But most of those, he said, they just nominally belong to a religion. So then among those who actually follow a religion, not just give it lip service, they're better. But even among those, they follow the religion, but just to get some material result. But better than those are people who actually seek self-realization, want to know what is the spirit, philosophers of the spirit. So in this way, he was focusing on a better and better eligibility to know the ultimate truth. And so then this verse occurs. He's saying that all these living entities, or the Sanskrit word is jiva, for a living entity, meaning a pure soul covered over by a body. So these living entities, they wander from one life to another. So this is something we should all think about in a very personal way, that we ourselves have been wandering from in different lifetimes. To put it simply, we've had past lives and we'll have future lives. And this present life that we have, it's just a brief one, and as Prabhupada used to say, it's a spot life on a long journey of going from one life to another. It's a very important concept to at least try to think about, even in daily life, because our tendency is to get so wrapped up in the affairs of this life. Even in this life, we don't even think of it in a long-term way. We just think of it today. How am I going to get through today? How am I going to get through this morning? And so forth and so on. But this whole life is one of many, many lifetimes that I've had. I don't remember them. I don't know what my future ones are. But according to Shastra, or scripture, and according to the nature of the soul, he has to accept different bodies because he's eternal. If at the end of the human life I could become perfect, then I would give up this journey from one life to another. I could get a spiritual body free of matter. But if I can't do that, then I continue on the journey. That's called karma and transmigration of the soul. Even without knowledge of exactly who I was in the past, though, it's a sober thought that we can try to use in a practical way in our life. Almost visualize all my lives lined up. Usually we think, at best, we think maybe back to our childhood and think of the events in our childhood leading up to now. But what about all the other lives? And they must have been, when you see an ant, when you see an animal being treated cruelly, or when you see the other side, it's dog-eat-dog world, one animal is eating another, all these different species, we've probably been one of those species. We shouldn't become proud or so limited as to think we're only this present body and its psyche. And psychology today, which is so prominent, also generally gives us the impression that the birth of this body and the childhood in this body, that's really forming our self. And that's the roots of, those are the roots of our self. Or perhaps a few generations back, we think we're Europeans and so on. I think I'm an American with European roots. People thinking their roots. But it goes so far back that it becomes meaningless into the animal species and the plant species. This also develops compassion when you think that all these different species, they're also souls and they're struggling. And so why should we interfere with their life? Let them elevate. All the souls are trying to make progress. And that's another very important point. As Rupa Goswami says, and I've told you what he said up to now, that there are many, many lives, but in all of the lives less than human, there's no chance for spiritual life. There's chance to eat, there's chance to mate, and to defend yourself, and to sleep. These are four animal propensities. The animals do them and we do them. But they have no chance for spiritual life. Their only chance is to live, and then after they die, they move up in the evolutionary scale. This is real evolution. Evolution means the evolution of the soul. And he rises generally. Animals, they don't commit sinful activities. So they gradually elevate themselves. And after many, many spot lives, they come to the human life. And the human life is a great opportunity not to enjoy better with your senses, but to get spiritual realization, meaning ultimately to get out of the cycle of birth and death and to realize love of Krishna. And if you blow it, if you don't do it, I mean, if you really misuse a human form of life, and down you go again into the lower species. Not out of some cruel punishment by nature or God, but by your own indication that I don't want this elevation, I don't want this human life of higher consciousness. I want a strong body. I want a body to enjoy in this way and that way. And you get it by the law of karma, by your own desire. So human life is so important to go one way or another. There's another verse reminiscent of this one in the Srimad Bhagavatam where a father and King Rishabhadev taught his sons and he told them, Nayam Deho Deha Bhajan Raloke, my dear sons, now that you've come to the human form of life, don't waste it. Don't be just like, he specifically says, a pig who eats the stool that he finds in the street. Use your human life for tapo dibyam putraka yena shatvam shujya jasyad brahmasokyam. Use it for austerity. That means use it to take a little trouble to understand yourself, purify yourself. Why? So that you can realize the highest pleasure, the eternal pleasure. This was the father's instruction. So Human life is a junction. And it's a thrilling notion that can come to us, not just theoretically, it can come even in the beginning of taking the Krishna consciousness, when you get a grasp on the fact that I'm a soul, I've been wandering, I don't know exactly what bodies I've had, but I can understand I've been wandering and suffering. Now, not only am I a human body, I may have been a human body many times, but now I'm a human body. In this human life, I have contacted a pure devotee. This is a high point in my evolution. This is happiness to understand like this, to get an inkling of our spiritual eternal nature and the understanding that my life is very auspicious so long as I manage it rightly. From here, I can go forward. And actually, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says some very reassuring things, that once you come to Krishna consciousness, if you do even a little devotional service, you at least won't get less than human body next time. And you'll get a good human body, meaning your parents will be devotees, like the children that we see here, who right from the beginning are being taught spiritual principles, who are becoming vegetarians and being introduced to God consciousness. Potentially, they get a head start. So that means that they must have performed devotional service before, didn't complete it, and so came back, but came back taking up where they left off in spiritual progress. So that's what our life is for. To make progress. And to whatever degree that we can manage our time and manage our lives, this should not be forgotten, that we're not just trying to survive in this life or make some progress that will end at death, that kind of progress in my bank account will end at the time of death or before. But make progress in this life in the eternal progress of the soul. So looking again at this verse, he's saying concisely what I've elaborated on. According to their karma, all living entities are wandering throughout the entire universe. Some of them are being elevated to the upper planetary systems, and some are going down into the lower planetary system. Out of many millions of wandering living entities, so one who is very fortunate gets an opportunity. It doesn't mean everybody gets this opportunity. The word here is Brahmanda Brahmite, wandering in the universe, Kona Bhagyavan. Bhagavan means fortunate, and Kona means someone, not everyone, is lucky to get the combined help of Krishna and Krishna's devotee. There's quite a combination of things. We may have made advancement in our past life so that we're looking for something more in this life, and therefore we meet the devotee of God. Or God within our heart prompts us. Actually, so these things are combined. There's a popular saying, almost a cliche, when the disciple is ready, the guru will come. But there's truth in that. What does it mean when the disciple is ready? That he gets some prompting within his heart, that when he meets a devotee, he thinks, oh, this is interesting, I want to inquire into this. There are so many people who are offered a book about Krishna consciousness, or offered some prasadam. When I say Krishna consciousness, that can apply to any form of pure love of God that is offered. So some people, they're generally impious, they're not interested in it, and some are. So that's, they're all souls, they're all pure. Why are some interested and some aren't? Some are getting promptings by God in the heart because they've already indicated their desire for this. Others have repeatedly turned away from God. The Upanishads give an example that the human form of life, or the human body, is like a tree, and on the tree there are two birds. And one bird is, we could say, the super soul, or Paramatma, a form of God in each person's heart. In the heart is God, the supreme soul, and my individual soul. So, what's the relationship? It's different according to your turning to him or turning away from him. So on this tree of the body, the individual tiny soul, he's usually just trying to taste, trying to enjoy the way a bird would enjoy berries on a tree. And the God bird is just standing by watching his friend. He's not interfering, but actually he gives him the facility to act. Every person in this world, he cannot act unless God helps him. Even for the most evil things that a person does, he can't figure out how to do it, how to make a nuclear weapon or how to mug someone on the street. God has to tell him, do it like this, do it like this. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, I am in everyone's heart, and from me comes intelligence and forgetfulness. But based on a long relationship with the super soul, that's the nature of our communication. So unfortunately, most people, you could say God has given up on them. He hasn't really, but his instructions are reaching deaf ears. They don't want to hear it. They have no conscience. So God has given them, all right, my dear son, I'll help you in your nefarious activities, but you have to take the reaction for it. So the other person indicates that he wants something else. So he is prompted to approach the pure devotee. Now one could say, why even bother with a pure devotee? Why not just be guided by God? But God says that I want you to come to me through my mercy as exhibited by devotees in this world. They're the carriers of my mercy for you. They will teach you so many practical ways. By your service to them, I'll be pleased. So we don't need any more explanation than that. That is Krishna's system, that you should approach him through his devotees. That is what pleases him and brings you direct contact with him. This is what's stated by Lord Chaitanya to Rupa Goswami, that after wandering through the universe, one who is very fortunate gets an opportunity to associate with a bona fide spiritual master by the grace of Krishna. By the mercy of both Krishna and the spiritual master, such a person receives the seed of the creeper of devotional service. So then we go forward with both, with the aid of both. After this verse, this example is developed more, that from Guru and Krishna, we get the seed of devotional service. And he literally follows the example, like from agriculture. You plant a seed in the earth, and then gradually it grows, but you have to water it, you have to protect the little plant. So this is the seed of love of God. And it means the instructions of developing love of God. Love of God is a natural thing, it's our nature, but in our present stage it will take development for it to come out again. It's been so long covered over. So the development is to follow different patterns of behavior that bring it out. Chant names of God. Hear, as I said in the very beginning, hear the scriptures to learn the science of God. Actual love, just as in this world, is not something that you do as forced. Or you don't love somebody because somebody told you to. Or completely opposite. How can you love if you don't love? You either love or you don't. But Bhakti, or devotional service, is such that if you practice it in the early stage, even before you love it, it will help you to develop love. For example, one of the processes that a devotee loves to do is he chants God's name, because God has invested his full presence in his holy names. But in the beginning, you may be too lazy or covered over to chant. But because the spiritual master asks you to chant, you have faith in him, you do it. This is an example. And by doing it, gradually love will develop. Or it's very favorable to rise early in the morning to begin spiritual practices. But a person doesn't want to do that and doesn't want to do so many things. But later, he will want to do them spontaneously. So the seed of devotion is planted, and the faithful and serious practitioner takes it up. This is the yoga of bhakti, or love of God. So maybe I'll stop here. When I looked at this verse and thought of presenting it, I thought especially these points seem most important to me, to grasp the concept of the long journey that we're on for many, many lifetimes, and not forget that or live with this idea that this life is all. Don't be caught at death with that mistaken idea. And then, to enact this practically, always think about how much progress you can make in this life and what that real progress is. And that would lead, and the nature of the progress is how much love we can develop to becoming active in devotional service to Krishna. All right, there's a lot here, and I've said a lot. Are there any questions or comments? That was for those. Well, see if there's anyone else. any questions? Yeah.
I've been developing it quite steadily, but I was here a couple of weeks ago, and Pastor Akash was giving a lecture, and some of the points that he made in one of the groups I read after he'd done it, felt a little bit shaken. It's been troubling me for a week or so. I think where it comes down to is that it's a fear of isolation, in that when I was reading his book, some of the things he was mentioning, like and some of the comments that you made during his lecture with regard to like, for example, things that I wanted to do, like travel around the world, see different countries, see different things, just meet different people, hear different people's ways. A lot of that doesn't seem to be promoted very well in what he's saying. It's caused some doubt with me. I think what it is that I have still got quite strong material entanglements, and that perhaps with time, as I develop a deeper understanding of Krishna, I don't hope that these would fall away. But right now, I'm just in a state of confusion in regard to that.
Well, of course, I don't want to make a judgment on what he might have said. Yeah, but just for a starter, he travels all around the world and meets people, so I don't see why he should tell you can't do it. But what Krishna teaches in the Bhagavad Gita is that whatever you have an inclination to do, you should do that for Krishna. Don't travel all over the world and, or whatever it is that you do, make money or raise children, make music. Don't do it and not offer it to Krishna. But that tendency to do what it is we want to do is very, very strong. And Krishna is intelligent about getting us to surrender. So he just doesn't tell us, you know, stop it, give it up, and immediately do everything I say, even against your nature. I've been practicing Krishna consciousness for quite a few years, and for me that's still a very important principle to do what I want to do, but offer it to Krishna, and try more and more to purify the offering so that it's not just really for me and then in a token way offer it to Krishna, but that I'm really giving my whole self, because this is really what I want to do. That becomes the same as what I want to give to you. I want to give to you the thing that I love the most. And then it becomes a kind of perfection of the self surrendered to Krishna. To attempt to completely give up things that are our nature is not Krishna's instruction. But it's like in the whole Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna was the warrior, and Krishna told him, you be the warrior for me. Arjuna was even thinking, well, maybe I shouldn't be a warrior. And Krishna said, no, this is your nature, but you do it my way. So anything that we do that's too artificial, it won't really last in the long run. That would be my advice. Yeah, and anything that, if you're feeling really like you say you're making some progress and now you're feeling you can't make progress, then there must be some misunderstanding, because it shouldn't be a block, or it shouldn't be like, well, I'll try to do this, but it's really against my nature, it's really against the grain. It should be possible at every step. And enjoyable, actually. Is that any more on that? No. Someone else? Yeah.
I'm not sure. I would be surprised if I did this, but I got to talk to you on Arjuna through the wire.
Is that what it means, that he was a warrior? Well, that's like a level of interpretation which is valid that you can make. In that sense, we're all warriors. We have to kill the false self. And Arjuna's being on the battlefield is like a symbol for all of us that, well, he was actually a military man. We're not. But the way he was on a battlefield with soldiers, we're on the battlefield of our daily life. Not only the false ego, but there's a lot of things we have to fight. And so we should be brave and fight in our own way. It doesn't mean fighting with guns. But so in that sense, life is a fight. Aside from that, we say the first meaning is that it is actual history, and Arjuna was a person in history who was a fighter, and Krishna was telling him to fight. But even that we can relate to our own life, that, as I just said, that was his, in Sanskrit called varna, or it was his, you could say, job occupation, or his psychological nature to be a fighter. And he was trained from his youth to do that. So we have some nature, and we should use that nature in Krishna's service. That's another meaning of Arjuna being a warrior. So you could take it literally to read the story and understand. I'm reading about a man who actually lived, a great soul, who was a soldier friend of Krishna's. But also it applies to me that whatever I am by social occupation, I should serve Krishna too. But if you want to take it, as you said, that's good too. That, as like Arjuna says at one point, that he won't fight. He says, he loses heart. He becomes cowardly in the beginning. He says, Govinda, I shall not fight. So then Krishna convinces him, you should fight. At the end, Arjuna says, then Krishna says, now I've taught you the whole Bhagavad Gita. What do you think? You can do whatever you want. And Arjuna says, my illusion is removed. Now I'm ready to fight. I want to do what you want me to do. So this is like the progress of the Bhagavad Gita. We're in our own illusion, and we have to not be afraid to fight, but we have to fight and be ready to do what Krishna wants. It's certainly not just a military treatise that we study in that way, but it also is the story of a military man who served God even by such an unlikely profession. Yes.
It seems like Arjuna seems to be on very unsteady ground when he first actually, well, at least under illusion, he was on unsteady ground. But as he progressed through the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna was giving him strength and more steady ground to stay on. So it seems like that in all like he's, especially in white Krishna consciousness, it seems like a builder. He has to first have a good foundation before he can move on and build. So it seems like we need a good foundation first before we can, like, this person wants to travel or something like that. It'd be nice to get a foundation of Krishna consciousness and then do all these things.
Yeah.
Like myself, I need a good foundation.
Yeah. I think there's an example, a story in the Bhagavatam that you know, you all know, except for him and the new persons, that there was once a fight between an elephant and a crocodile in the water. And although the elephant was very strong, he was not in his element. He's a creature of the land. The crocodile belongs in the water, so he was really fighting. He got more and more strength. So out of that, Prabhupada makes this amazing purport. And he says that in order to fight illusion, we should have a strong, you use the word foundation, but he said we should be in a natural position where our senses are strong so that we can fight, or like our feet are strong on the ground. And he referred, then he got to the specific point that a man may need to be married. And then if you ask him to be, you'd be complete celibate. It'd be so hard for him to do that he'd be weak. And then all kinds of Maya would knock him over. But if he's married, that would be in a religious kind of marriage, he'd be better able to fight. So Prabhupada says, each person has to find a situation where his senses are strong and he feels natural for what you could also say is like the long-term haul of Krishna consciousness, and not something that makes us weak. In Arjuna's case, what he needed was knowledge. He didn't get married. He was already married. He didn't change his profession. He was already in the profession of for himself. But he was in illusion about his attachment to his relatives. So Krishna had to clear up so many things. But whatever it is, we have to get a good, yes, your point is nice, get a good foundation, a Krishna conscious foundation in which to fight Maya. And therefore we need the spiritual master to make sure that it's the foundation. If the foundation itself is illusion, then it's not a foundation. We've misled. Hello?
Basis to think, sometimes I think about getting through today or tomorrow or whatever, but in spiritual life, it's like
right, okay, so we're turning, kind of thing. So what is it that we can enthuse ourselves on the way to keep that goal in mind, you know, because we tend to feed on results, on some kind of feedback.
Well, one thing would be the same as the material progress that you made, that you like to see some milestones or some signs along the way that I am getting somewhere. But that would seem to be one thing. Assurances of something like that. Then we know it's real, and I'm enjoying the progress I've made. Presumably, the thing that we're working on is something that we'd like to master. We'd like to enjoy the results, and we start getting some benefits. And so you may say, "Well, how can I tell?" But you can tell, of course, that let's say a musical instrument. First of all, you couldn't play it at all, but now you can play a few tunes, and people like to hear it or something like that. So it's kind of like that. So in spiritual life, also, you are able to give up things that you're told in the scriptures that this is really going to stop you completely. You're attached to smoking, you're attached to illicit sex, meat eating. How are you going to make progress? You're doing these things. And then you give them up and you feel, this is something. And this can be checked when you, again, associate with your former friends who are still doing these things, and they say, "Hey, why don't you do this again with us?" And you say, "No." They say, "Oh, you're afraid? What's the matter?" And you say, "Well, actually, I don't have any taste for this anymore." And you can realize that I've actually progressed. Unfortunately, they're an illusion. They think this is nice. So you can see a devotee is humble. He doesn't like to even see so much progress because he's kind of embarrassed because he thinks, "Oh, if I see that I'm making too much progress, I'll get proud and I'll..." Then if I get proud, then I'll lose it. Because it's kind of a subtle, spiritual life is a subtle thing, what it actually is, what progress is. But to get some sense of it, there are definitely ways to check it. Prabhupada gave that example that when you get on the big airplane, then you may not even notice that it takes off. And suddenly, if you're occupied in certain things, you don't notice. And then you hear the captain say, "We're now at 20,000 feet," or you look out and you see, you didn't even notice the progress, but it's definitely going on. That would be one example that would occur to me to actually check the progress. And then the other is, at least I'm working. Oh, another one would be patience. That's important for progress. In a sense, it's like the opposite of checking, is to just keep at it. And all the acharya, Rupa Goswami says, just be patient and work it. You're in the right place, you're doing the right thing, now be patient. And our version of patience is often impatience. We say, "Well, I am patient. I've been trying hard and I've been working a long time." And in effect, Krishna is saying, "You haven't been trying so hard. You haven't been doing it so long. Be patient." So, progress is linked with patience in that it's part of the faith in the process. That I don't see so much signs. I've been practicing so long, I don't see all these signs. But all right, I'll just be patient. I know that the result will come gradually enough. And then, of course, don't be very careful. Even be afraid. Narottam Das Thakur says even fear can be used in devotional service. Be afraid of deviating. And all Rupa Goswami is saying, we've come through so many species of life, and we're feeling, "Boy, I've never been so fortunate. Now I've met a spiritual master." So be very careful that you don't do something to really hamper your progress, to really check it completely. You do some real bad aparad or really some bad thing. So that would be another, say, way of considering progress. Come to the human form of life. Now don't suddenly give it all up just because there's some problem or disruption, and stop the progress that you've made. serious aparad. So those are some thoughts about how to feel, how to work with progress. So that at the time of death, we don't know where we're going, but at least we can think, well, I got this human form of life, and I hope I made some progress, and I hope in the next life I'll make more progress. Life should be progressive, going forward. It's a very good feeling that we may have, that we have done that right thing so far, and be grateful that we have met Krishna in this way. We're making progress.